Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. It's early spring, 1950, in Washington, D.C. Senator Joseph McCarthy is anxiously scanning a crowd of faces. They pass by in a stream. Legislative aides, congressmen, senators, White House staffers. They're all part of the machine that drives Washington. But McCarthy isn't focused on any of them right now. He's standing on the steps of the Capitol looking for a single person. A man who's politically connected and could hold the keys to McCarthy's future. He's supposed to arrive any minute. As McCarthy gazes across the Capitol, he spots a fellow Republican who smiles and tips his fedora. McCarthy nods, but he can't bring himself to return the friendly grin. Not today. He's under too much pressure. More than a month ago, McCarthy gave a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, claiming he knew of 205 communists working in the State Department. It was a shocking allegation, but it paid off. McCarthy ended up scoring headlines across the country. And even though he's the junior senator from Wisconsin, McCarthy is now in the national spotlight. It's a dream come true. But there's a problem. McCarthy made up those allegations. He hasn't found any communists who've infiltrated the government. And if he doesn't act quickly to find some real subversives, then he's going to be ridiculed on the national stage or suffer an even worse fate. That's why he's here today. McCarthy found someone who may be able to help out and give McCarthy the names of some actual spies inside the government. Right then, McCarthy feels a hand on his shoulder. He startles and turns. Standing before him is a man who's well over 6 feet tall. He has beady, serious eyes and dark hair that's slicked back from a widow's peak. The man reaches out a hand. "Senator McCarthy, Don Serene."
"Ah, thank God. I thought you'd never come. Busy day in the nation's capital."
"No kidding.
I know I've got my hands full."
"Well, that's why I'm here. But should we find somewhere to talk? Somewhere more private?" McCarthy looks at all the people passing by. He's right. If they're going to speak honestly, they can't be overheard. So McCarthy gestures away from the Capitol.
"Yeah, let's take a walk."
Together, the two walk through the U.S. Capitol grounds beside a wide stretch of grass. And as they walk, McCarthy finally feels himself starting to relax. This man, Don Serene, is a former FBI agent. He knows how to find information, and the FBI director himself, J. Edgar Hoover, offered to help McCarthy in his hunt. But McCarthy knows that if he wants to get anything done, he'll have to be honest.
"So, Don, I'm going to level with you. I'm in a tough place. We need to find those communists in the State Department. Every week that this goes on, I'm getting more pressure to name names."
"Well, of course, Senator. I can start working on your list of the 205 suspects. We'll find the strongest cases."
"Yeah. Don, listen, that number, 205, that was just me winging it. Truth is, I don't have a single name."
McCarthy waits to see Serene's reaction, but the former FBI agent simply smiles.
"Oh, don't worry, Senator. You'll be all right. You have the full cooperation of the FBI. They'll pass me all the information we need."
"So you're saying we'll find the spies?"
"Well, Senator, that's the thing. You're setting a very high bar. We don't need to catch spies. All we need to do is find people who are suspicious."
"Oh, you're right. We're on the verge of a nuclear war with Stalin and the Soviets. Mao has an army in China. People are scared. So commies or pinkos or leftists, they all could be spies. Who even cares about the differences? We're all the same, a threat to the American way of life."
"Well, I know Director Hoover agrees. So there's only one decision you still have to make."
"And what's that?"
Serene smiles again and cracks his knuckles.
"Well, tell me, are you ready to get to work?"
McCarthy looks up at the massive dome of the U.S. Capitol. It houses the most powerful politicians in the country. And if this plan goes well, then McCarthy will be the most powerful of them all. So with a big grin, he slaps Serene on the back and says yes, he's ready to go on a hunt. Together, they're going to track down subversives, whether or not they're actually communists. McCarthy admits they may earn themselves enemies. It will be hard and exhausting, but they'll do whatever it takes, even if it means playing dirty.
American Scandal is sponsored by Audible.
I get the thrill of, say, skydiving, but it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin Modern Classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In February of 1950, Senator Joseph McCarthy launched a crusade to root out communists from the U.S. government. This came at a time when Americans had grown more fearful of the Soviet Union and the global spread of communism. But for McCarthy, what began as an off-the-cuff speech quickly snowballed into a national obsession, one that would earn him fame and political power. And once McCarthy seized the national spotlight, he was determined to hold on to it. He enlisted allies across the government, and soon his crusade grew even larger. But that earned him powerful enemies, and soon his enemies grew determined to stop McCarthy's rise. This is Episode 2, Loyal Americans. It's midday in the spring of 1950. A light rain is falling in Washington, D.C., and a man in a pinstripe suit dashes through the streets. He ducks under an awning and approaches a wooden door. When he opens it, a welcome blast of warm air greets him as he steps into the Carroll Arms Hotel, and then he begins looking for Senator Joseph McCarthy. Lou Nichols is an assistant director of the FBI. He's in his mid-40s with heavy-lidded eyes and a jutting chin. He approaches a host at the hotel and asks whether Senator McCarthy has arrived. The host turns and points and says McCarthy is sitting at his regular lunch table. Nichols walks toward McCarthy, and as he does, he reviews his plan for the meeting. First, he needs to teach McCarthy how to work with the press. McCarthy is on a crusade against communists, and for Nichols and the FBI, that's a good thing. They're on a similar mission, and they can use a man like McCarthy. Through him, the FBI can influence headlines and continue to shape the public's opinion about communism. But Nichols also has his own agenda. He wants to get a close look at McCarthy to see whether this senator is trustworthy. So Nichols approaches the table and takes off his wet jacket. McCarthy looks up and nods. Then he slams back the remainder of a martini and orders another. Then he gestures to a chair. Nichols sits, and before he can say a word, McCarthy blurts it out. He wants to know if the assistant director of the FBI has any names to provide today. Nichols hesitates, but he's not going to lie. So he shakes his head and says no. He doesn't have any new names of communists in the government. A waitress appears with another martini, and without saying thank you, McCarthy grabs it and takes a large gulp. He glares at Nichols and reminds him that he's a U.S. senator. McCarthy asks why exactly the two of them are meeting if Nichols doesn't have anything new to add. Nichols takes a moment to study McCarthy. He has to admit he's fascinated to see McCarthy in person. He's seen those dark, arching eyebrows from the front page of so many newspapers. McCarthy is now world famous. But Nichols works in intelligence, and he knows how to read people. McCarthy is an easy subject. First things first, he appears to have a drinking problem. That's good to know, in case the FBI ever needs to wield that information later. But more importantly, McCarthy appears to be entirely self-interested. He's concerned only with himself, his own image, his own power. It's a dangerous combination. With men like McCarthy, Nichols knows what he has to do. He starts with a bit of flattery. He tells McCarthy that he admires his cause, that he's done good, meaningful work, and he wants to help any way he can. The FBI wants to see him triumph. Nichols can see a satisfied smile forming on McCarthy's face. All right, that's good. That means he's gotten through, even if he had to lie. Because the truth is, McCarthy has barely made a dent in the fight against communism. It's President Truman who really deserves credit. He issued a loyalty order that's already vetted the political beliefs of 5 million federal employees. And beyond Truman, for years, the House Un-American Activities Committee has interrogated private citizens for even a hint of subversion. Still, Nichols knows that if McCarthy is going to be useful, the man needs to feel important. So Nichols praises him again. McCarthy then takes another gulp of his martini and asks, if the FBI doesn't have names, what else can they do? Nichols says he has some ideas. If McCarthy is going to name communists, he should first understand how to handle newspapers. McCarthy raises an eyebrow and says he's already got the press eating out of his hand. If anything, he should be giving advice to the FBI. Nichols smiles and says he agrees. McCarthy has proven himself to be a genius with the press, but there are strategies he may not know, like planting information at exactly the right time to make sure it becomes a story in a paper. Suddenly, McCarthy looks very interested, and Nichols knows his approach is working. So he keeps flattering McCarthy while giving him proven methods to manipulate journalists. It's a treasure trove of FBI strategies, and as the conversation goes on, McCarthy increasingly seems like he will be willing to use them. Soon, Nichols finishes giving his lesson, and McCarthy finishes drinking his last martini. He's now swaying as he talks, and he tells Nichols that they're going to be a good team, him and the FBI. Together, they'll expose the communists. Nichols feels proud of himself. The FBI now has another ally in Congress, someone who will help push the Bureau's agenda. So Nichols rises and thanks McCarthy for his time, and he puts his coat back on and makes his way out of the hotel. But as he steps out into the rain, suddenly Nichols is hit with a terrible feeling. This meeting may have been a success, but what if it was a mistake? What if he just gave powerful tools to the wrong man? What if the FBI just helped create a monster? It's late spring, 1950, in Washington, D.C. Margaret Chase Smith walks down a long corridor in the Capitol building, her heels clicking on the marble floor. The hallway is crowded with senators and their aides, and Smith smiles and waves as she passes by. Smith is a U.S. senator from Maine. She's the first woman who served in the Senate without being appointed or having a connection as a widow. She also served in the House, and that makes her the first woman to have been in both chambers of Congress. But right now, Smith isn't thinking about milestones. She has a full day ahead of her, and now that the Senate is in recess, she has to keep pushing forward with work. So she hurries through the corridor, her pearl necklace bouncing as she walks. But when she turns a corner, she spots Senator Joseph McCarthy, and her heart starts to beat fast. Smith is a proud Republican. She's staunchly anti-communist. So when she first heard McCarthy's accusations about communists in the State Department, she was deeply concerned. But then McCarthy changed his story. At first, he said 205 communists had infiltrated the State Department. Then he dropped the number to 57. And now he just changed the story again and dropped the numbers even more. Though this time, he finally released a few actual names. But it's not just the shifting accusations that has Smith worried. It's the effect he's had in Washington. People are now scared of being caught in the crosshairs of McCarthy's investigation. They worry that their lives could be ruined, even if they're innocent. So Smith decides that she needs to confront McCarthy and challenge him on his false claims. Smith takes a deep breath and approaches McCarthy. Joe, I'd like a word if you have a moment.
Hello, Margaret. You look awful serious. What's bothering you?
Look, I won't sugarcoat it. I'm concerned about what you're doing. These people you're naming in the press, Joe, they're career civil servants. Where's your proof that they're actually communists?
Margaret, read the papers. You'll see the proof.
I have read the papers, Joe, and I've seen your supposed proof.
Well, then you've seen everything you need. These people I've named, they had affiliations with communist front groups.
Joe, you're making a serious leap. These people are associated with liberal groups, sure, but that does not make them communists. At that, McCarthy's face grows red. He points a finger and raises his voice.
You don't get it, do you? These are groups that no God-fearing American should ever join. If you're too stupid to see it, then you're part of the problem.
Smith is shocked. She expected McCarthy's bluster, but she did not expect that he'd imply anything about her allegiances. Joe, listen. We answer to something called the Constitution. It gives people freedoms. It sets limits on what you and I can do. Now, as far as I can see, you haven't proven a single one of your charges. And understand something. You're making Washington a dark place. My aides say they won't even attend dinner parties anymore. And that's because of you. They're worried you might accuse their friends, and then they'll be labeled communists themselves.
Well, I think that's ridiculous, because any loyal American has nothing to fear.
And I suppose you're the one who decides who's loyal and who isn't. That sounds more like a czar than a senator.
Oh, I'd be careful, Margaret.
People talk about you as a future vice presidential candidate. But remember, I control the votes at the Wisconsin convention.
With that, McCarthy turns and walks away. Smith stares at him with a look of fury. She can't believe this. She wanted to believe her fellow Republican was better than this. She hoped that at worst he was just sloppy or reckless. But now she doesn't have any doubt left. She has to stop Joseph McCarthy, no matter the cost, because she can't let the fight against communism get hijacked by a man who operates like Joseph Stalin. It's June 1st, 1950, in Washington, D.C. Senator Margaret Chase Smith walks down the floor of the U.S. Senate and stares at the marble statues on the upper level of the chamber. They're statues of leaders like Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, politicians who were never afraid to take a stand for their beliefs, even when doing so put them in danger. These reminders of brave leaders give her strength, and she needs it because right now she's about to give the most important speech of her life. Smith pauses and looks out at the chamber full of U.S. senators. She locks eyes with Senator Charles Toby, one of her friends. She told him her plans for today. She's going to speak out against Joseph McCarthy, even if he is popular, and even if he's done a good job attacking the Democratic president, Harry Truman. This speech may hurt her career. McCarthy may see her as an enemy and counterattack. But there's something far more important than her own reelection. It's protecting America from tyrants and liars like Joseph McCarthy. Smith clears her throat and locks eyes with McCarthy himself. And then she begins. She says she'd like to speak about a national issue. America has been seized by a collective feeling of fear and frustration. Already, innocent lives have been harmed as a result of selfish political opportunism. Smith looks up and sees many of her colleagues turning toward McCarthy. Smith decided not to use McCarthy's name out of a sense of decorum, but everyone in the chamber knows who she's talking about. Smith goes on and reminds the Senate that the Constitution speaks of trial by jury. The United States does not conduct trials by accusation, but Americans are now scared. They're afraid to speak their minds if doing so means they'll be smeared as communists by their opponents, even by their neighbors. Smith looks out at her Republican colleagues and can tell that they're moved by her words. It fills her with further strength and courage. She tells the chamber that it's time for Republicans and Democrats to stop thinking about ugly smears that might win them elections. They have to start thinking patriotically, as Americans, devoted to individual freedom. Smith concludes her speech, warning that if there is no change, the American way of life, what they've cherished for so long, will come to an end. Smith looks out again at her colleagues, can see that some of them are nearly in tears. That's good, she thinks. Maybe they'll take action and put an end to the madness of Joseph McCarthy. But she can only hope, because if none of the senators do anything, if they put their own self-interests above the interests of the country, if that happens, then Joseph McCarthy's reign of terror has only just begun. American Scandal is sponsored by the new podcast, Homegrown OKC. Every American has a memory of where they were when. Where they were when the towers fell on 9/11. Where they were when Kennedy was shot. When Columbine or Sandy Hook or Uvalde happened. These were moments so singular, you'll never forget where you were when you heard the news. For me, April 19th, 1995, the Oklahoma City bombing was one of those moments. I was in college, huddled with others around the TV in the common room,
watching scenes of smoke and rubble. It's been almost 30 years since then, and still the OKC bombings haunt us. But why? Well, perhaps as the new podcast Homegrown OKC points out in the very first episode, we're still grappling with far-right extremism, racism, conspiratorial thinking, and mental illness. Homegrown OKC tells the story of McVeigh and his crimes, revealing that there's a lot more to it than we knew. Listen in to Homegrown OKC to find out more. To listen to Homegrown OKC, search for Homegrown OKC in your podcast app. That's Homegrown, one word, OKC.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It's June 9th, 1950, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Joseph McCarthy stands backstage in a large auditorium and closes his eyes. He listens to the rumblings of thousands of people. They sound like a gathering storm, cheering and chanting, all waiting for McCarthy to speak. McCarthy tries to steady his mind. He needs to focus and shake off his nerves. This speech needs to go perfectly. Right now, McCarthy is at the Republican State Convention for Wisconsin. Thousands of voters have descended on Milwaukee, and all are waiting to hear McCarthy preach about the evils of communism and the existential threats that America is currently facing. It's a political platform that's won McCarthy international fame, but it's also earned him a number of enemies. Just 8 days ago, one of his supposed Republican allies spoke out against him in a fiery speech on the floor of the Senate. The senator seemed proud of herself, and McCarthy couldn't help but sneer at her false attempt to look like a patriot. He knows what real patriotism looks like. It's about going after people who are bent on destroying America. Still, after the senator finished her speech, McCarthy could tell she'd done real damage. She had actually swayed some of her colleagues. And now it seems like McCarthy's enemies are lining up against him. That's why today's speech is so important. If McCarthy wins over all these people, he'll have the strength of a solid voting base, and he won't have to worry about political enemies in Washington. McCarthy takes another deep breath as a priest recites the Pledge of Allegiance. The crowd applauds, and then McCarthy takes the stage. Right away, the applause turns into wild cheers, and the audience comes out of their seats. McCarthy waves and steps in front of a microphone. His legs feel shaky. He has given lots of speeches like this one, but this feels especially monumental. So he braces himself and delivers the line like he knows the back of his hand. It's good to get away from Washington and back here in the United States. The crowd roars, and all at once, McCarthy knows he doesn't have to worry. He launches into it. He viciously attacks Margaret Chase Smith, the senator who spoke out against him. At the mere mention of her name, the crowd begins to boo. McCarthy grins and says people like Smith claim that he's on a witch hunt, that he's smearing people, but the truth is his critics are the ones on the witch hunt. They're whining and moaning while he gets done the real work of fighting communism. The audience again bursts into applause. McCarthy decides to double down. He announces that this isn't time for caution. Not when communists are taking over Korea. Not when Stalin is getting ready to launch a nuclear weapon. McCarthy then pauses. He knows what he's about to say could be the biggest risk of the entire speech. His aides have told him to temper his accusations, to stop throwing out allegations he can't back up. They say it could be his undoing this time. But McCarthy knows they're wrong. There's a reason he's standing on stage and they are not. So he pulls out a briefcase and grabs a handful of papers. He lifts the papers high and tells the crowd that he's holding a new list, a list of 106 State Department employees who are loyal to the Communist Party. And he says that the time has come to root them out. The crowd roars, and McCarthy feels like he's floating off the ground. It's true, he did just take a big risk. There are no actual names on that list. But for McCarthy, that's beside the point. He has no doubt that enemies have infiltrated the government. And if he exposes them, he'll not only make the country stronger and more secure, but he'll gain an even bigger following. A following strong enough to protect him from even his most powerful opponents. A year later, Don Serene hurries through the U.S. Capitol as he makes his way to the Senate chamber. He needs to find his boss, Joseph McCarthy, before it's too late, and before McCarthy makes a terrible mistake. Serene is a former FBI agent, and he's been helping McCarthy as the senator looks for communists in the U.S. government. For the most part, it's been good work, even if McCarthy is often reckless with the truth. And while McCarthy has taken a lot of political risks, none are as risky as the speech he's planning to give today. The two worked on it together, but Serene realized it was a mistake. That's why he has to stop McCarthy from giving the speech. Serene arrives at the Senate chamber and walks out onto the Senate floor. The senator's desks are mostly empty, and it seems that members of both parties have little appetite for Joseph McCarthy or any of his big accusations. Serene spots McCarthy and hurries over to the senator. As he walks over, McCarthy looks up, seeming both surprised and irritated to see him. Serene apologizes for bothering him right before he's about to give a speech, but he leans in closer and whispers that he thinks McCarthy should seriously reconsider what he's about to say. McCarthy shakes his head, and he tells Serene absolutely not. It's time to make a big splash. Serene lowers his voice and asks if McCarthy realizes what he's about to do. In a matter of minutes, he's going to accuse George Marshall of being a communist conspirator. George Marshall, the Secretary of Defense, a five-star general from World War II, the author of the Marshall Plan, a program that many credit with saving Europe at the end of the war. McCarthy is about to call this man a communist. McCarthy shoots Serene a bored look, and then opens up his briefcase and begins rifling through papers. He seems unbothered, and so Serene decides to spell it out even further. He warns McCarthy that if he goes after Marshall, he could destroy his own political future. It's just not worth the risk. McCarthy lays a paper on his desk and begins writing notes. Without looking up, he tells Serene that his decision is final. It's his duty to root out any communist he finds, and George Marshall is the biggest communist dope in the history of American government. Serene is stunned by the false accusation, but McCarthy is his boss, so he needs to find a tactful way to change his mind. Serene agrees that Marshall may be a communist dope. He did let Mao take China, but Serene adds that the public loves George Marshall, so he gives McCarthy a suggestion. If he's going to give the speech, he should just cool down the rhetoric. McCarthy sets down his pen and looks up at Serene and says that Serene needs to relax. He's just going to knock Marshall down a peg or two. It's nothing big. With that, McCarthy rises and walks to the podium. Serene's mouth goes dry as he watches McCarthy step up to the microphone. He hopes that he got through to his boss. But when McCarthy opens his mouth, Serene realizes that it was a lost cause. Right away, McCarthy launches into a blistering attack. He accuses George Marshall of running the biggest communist conspiracy in the history of the world. Serene feels his stomach sinking as McCarthy continues to attack Marshall. And as McCarthy keeps ranting and raving, Serene realizes that one thing is now entirely clear. Joseph McCarthy has crossed a line, a bright red line. He's made a fatal mistake. It's October 3rd, 1952. On a train in the upper Midwest, Dwight D. Eisenhower looks out the window at a tall field of corn. It blows in the wind like so many cornfields Eisenhower has already seen. Eisenhower is traveling across the country as he runs for president of the United States. He's riding in his own train, dedicated to the campaign. The train has passed through state after state, and this area looks like just another stretch of the farm belt. But then Eisenhower receives an update from an aide. They've just entered Wisconsin. Eisenhower groans. Wisconsin is Joseph McCarthy's state. And that means soon they'll be coming to a stop, and Eisenhower will have to make the choice between two very unsavory options. The first is that he plays nice and pretends to get along with McCarthy, who's a fellow Republican. McCarthy himself is running for re-election, and Eisenhower knows the party needs to stay unified. By acting cordial with the senator, Eisenhower could help the Republican Party. The other option is that Eisenhower makes McCarthy squirm as he shows the whole world what a snake the senator truly is. Eisenhower prefers the second option because he hates Joseph McCarthy with a deep passion. He could never stand a man who would lie about his service in the war. But his hate truly blossomed when McCarthy called George Marshall a communist traitor. Marshall's no traitor. He's a hero. He's also Eisenhower's good friend and mentor. Now, as the train heads into McCarthy's home state, Eisenhower will have to decide what's more important, helping the GOP or standing up for what's right. Eisenhower's campaign manager approaches and takes a seat across the aisle. Sometime soon, we'll be stopping in Milwaukee. Eisenhower shakes his head. I know what you're going to say. You want me to get down on my knees and kiss the ground that Joe McCarthy walks on, right? Well, come on, Ike. The man's a Republican. He's running for re-election. This is his home state, so just play nice. It'll help you, too. Don't forget that you also need to win Wisconsin. You know, I don't believe I get it. This man makes baseless accusations. He ends people's careers. He goes to the floor of the U.S. Senate and lies about Marshall, a war hero. Every senator, every journalist, they all denounce McCarthy, and yet that doesn't do anything. He's still one of the most popular politicians in the country. Like I said, I just don't get it. Yeah, well, he knows how to whip up fear. It gets him attention. It gets him followers. But it's not right. So why are we pretending it is? Ike, right now, don't worry about what's right. Certainly not a month before Election Day. Eisenhower grows darkly serious. It's exactly because it's a month before the election that we should worry about what's right. This is when it counts. I could embarrass him. I could put an end to the reign of Joseph McCarthy. Ike, listen. You hurt McCarthy, you hurt yourself. And that wouldn't do anyone any good. So just smile. Let him be. Let him be. I was the supreme commander of the Allied forces. You're telling me that I can't take on Joe McCarthy? No, you can take him on, but please, Ike, win the presidency first. Then bash him all you want. But today, just be a politician for once. Pretend. Eisenhower clenches his jaws. Nothing feels more reprehensible than aiding Joseph McCarthy. He stands against everything that Eisenhower fought for in the war. But Eisenhower knows his campaign manager is right. Okay. I will pretend, and I'll smile. The campaign manager pats Eisenhower on the shoulder. Then he rises and walks through the train car, which bumps and shakes as it continues down the tracks. Eisenhower looks back out at the cornfield. He feels lost in a boundless expanse of anger and resentment. He knew that running for president meant that he'd have to make certain compromises. It's the nature of politics. But he also knows that at the end of the day, you still have to do what's right. And Eisenhower worries that he just made a very bad decision. Because if he can't stand up to Joe McCarthy, then who will?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend. Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
It's late fall 1952 in Washington, D.C. Inside a bar near the Capitol, Robert Taft takes a sip of rye whiskey as he flips through a newspaper. The drink burns as it goes down, and Taft grimaces. But it's not the whiskey that's giving him pain. It's the headlines he's staring at right now. Just weeks ago, the nation went to the polls and cast their votes. The results were unequivocal. They wanted Republicans in power. Dwight Eisenhower won the presidency in a landslide, and Republicans took control of both the House and the Senate. This should be good news for Taft, who's a Republican senator from Ohio, because come January, he'll be the new Senate majority leader. But as Taft sinks deeper into a leather booth, he stares at the newspaper and comes face to face with his one remaining problem. Joseph McCarthy, a Republican Wisconsin senator who also won in the election and who once again is dominating the headlines. McCarthy is a serious liability. Somehow Taft has to find a way to deal with him. Taft places his tumbler on the table and looks up from the paper. That's when he sees a friend approaching. It's George Aiken, a powerful Republican senator from Vermont. He's trim with a messy fuzz of white hair. He slides into the booth looking apologetic. Bob, I'm sorry I'm late. Oh, don't apologize. This here, George, this is what's grinding me. Taft slides the newspaper across the table and Aiken glances at it. Oh. McCarthy says there will be no mercy in the fight against Reds. Well, looks like Joe's up to his old tricks. George, they're more than tricks. Listen, McCarthy's going to be a real problem for us, despite his promise. Now, he said he'd back off after he won re-election, tamp it down. But it's only been a few weeks. And he's at it again. He can't help himself. He's just got to be in the papers. Yeah, well, let him have it. No, I don't think you understand, George. I'm coming in as Senate Majority Leader. This is our chance. We've got the White House. We've got both houses of Congress. We need to be disciplined and organized. But this guy is turning things into a circus. Well, you know what they say. There's no business like show business. George, I'm being serious here. We do not want or need a circus. We don't need his crusade against communists. I know. It gets people to vote. But it makes no sense to rail against communists in government. Not now, and not when your own party controls the government. Goodness gracious, can't he see that? A waitress approaches and sets down a couple of drinks. Aiken takes a sip of gin and looks back at Taft. Bob, you think we would have won both houses if we didn't have McCarthy? Be honest. Joe created a winning issue. He got people stirred up, and they showed up. They showed up at the polls in droves, which means we owe him. Yeah, that's the way it works. Nah, but you don't see, he's going to be a distraction. He's going to drag the party down. This is our chance to push big, bold policy. We have the power. But we'll lose that focus every time there's a new headline about McCarthy, some crazy accusation about spies or double agents or secret dossiers. And that's not all of it. It's not just bad for the party. He's going to do real harm to real people. That's the thing, isn't it? Well, we've got to find a way to neutralize him. How do we do that without crossing him? Well, hell if I know. God, you know the worst part is I'll probably have to make him a committee chair. Oh, God. Yeah. You're going to be the majority leader. Put him somewhere he can't cause any harm. Stroke his ego, but keep him powerless. Taft taps his fingers on the table as he thinks. Then he smiles. Powerless. Yeah, that's a damn good idea. Well, McCarthy's already a senior Republican on the Government Operations Committee. That's a natural chairmanship. A good title. But Government Operations, he'll be stuck reading a report on how much we spend on paperclips. Attaboy, Bob, see? Problem solved. Well, you know, I think it is. So, let's drink to that. The senators raise their glasses and cheers, and Taft grins with a feeling of relief. Because for the first time since the election results came in, he has a plan. He'll be able to control the party and its most out-of-control senator. He'll ship McCarthy off and place him far from the action and far from any real power. But McCarthy will be happy with his new title, and hopefully he'll stop making so much noise. And then the world can finally move on from Joseph McCarthy and his preposterous lies about communists hiding in the government. It's December 1953 at the Astor Hotel in New York City. In a suite on the top floor, men and women mingle. They're in tuxedos and dresses and clink glasses as they gaze across New York's skyline. Joseph McCarthy weaves through a group while gripping a double martini in his right hand. He pats a friend on the shoulder and cracks a quick joke and makes his way back to the bar. It's time for a refill. So far, the night's off to a good start. McCarthy is hosting the party as a celebration of his recent victory at the polls. He was re-elected to the Senate, and in January, he'll return to Washington for another six-year term. But tonight, McCarthy's goal isn't just to drink a lot of alcohol and have some fun, even though he plans to do exactly that. No, for McCarthy, tonight is also about business. There's a man he wants to spend some time talking to, a high-powered attorney, and McCarthy wants to bring him on to his staff. McCarthy believes that together, the two of them could take Washington by storm. As a bartender gives McCarthy another martini, he spots the man enter the room. He has slicked back hair, drowsy-looking eyes. A scar runs down the middle of his nose like some sort of battle wound. McCarthy recognizes him instantly from his picture in the paper. His name is Roy Cohn. He's only 24 years old, but already he's made a name for himself in the Department of Justice. He works as a U.S. attorney, which makes him one of the most powerful lawyers in the country. And that's exactly what Joseph McCarthy needs right now. In January, McCarthy is going to step into a new role, the chairman of the Government Operations Committee. It's obvious that the Senate's leadership was trying to sideline him by giving him what they thought was a toothless committee. But McCarthy knows something that they don't. With his chairmanship, he'll also be the head of a subcommittee for government investigations. The Senate leadership doesn't realize it, but with that subcommittee, McCarthy will have nearly unlimited power. That's why he needs to talk with Roy Cohn. McCarthy will need a prosecutor for his subcommittee, someone who's tough as nails. And it's a perfect description of Roy Cohn. McCarthy takes a sip of his martini and approaches Cohn. The two shake hands, but instead of opening with pleasantries, McCarthy goes straight into the pitch. He tells Cohn that he's looking for a chief counsel for his investigation subcommittee. He wants to know if Cohn would like the job. Cohn smiles politely and thanks McCarthy. He says he's honored and surprised, but he should be candid. He doesn't see how he could advance his career working for a Senate subcommittee. It seems like small potatoes compared to the work he's been doing at the Department of Justice. McCarthy agrees and says he understands. On the surface, there's no glory being a staffer on a congressional subcommittee. No doubt about it. But McCarthy adds that this subcommittee is different. It might look boring, but if Cohn looks a little deeper, he'll get a strong whiff of its power. Cohn smiles and says he's ready to take a whiff. He wants to know what McCarthy's talking about. So McCarthy leans in and explains that through the subcommittee, the two can use the power of the subpoena to root out communists in the government. Their work could be big. Cohn nods his head, thinking, and says he's impressed with McCarthy's plan, but he still shouldn't take the job. He'd be better off as a U.S. attorney. Cohn reminds McCarthy that he helped get the death penalty for the Soviet spies Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. He's not just throwing around accusations. But McCarthy was prepared for this response, and so he reminds Cohn that the thing is, he only has so much power as a U.S. attorney. He has to eliminate communists one by one, case by case, and at that pace, he'll never have any real impact. But the Senate offers something completely different. He won't need probable cause or mounds of evidence. He could haul in any government employee he wanted and question them under oath. Cohn looks off into the distance, and McCarthy can see the gears turning. He knows he's got the young man's attention, but then Cohn turns back with a skeptical look on his face. Cohn points out that McCarthy hasn't yet bagged a single communist. He's made a lot of noise, but he's only gotten a few bureaucrats to resign, and only because they were sick of his questioning. McCarthy points a finger at Cohn, says that that's all going to change once he's chair of the investigation subcommittee. There won't be enough prison cells for all the communists he's going to take down. So if Cohn wants in, now's his chance. McCarthy extends his hand and looks expectantly at Cohn. For a moment, the young lawyer hesitates, but then he offers a cocky smile, gives McCarthy a firm handshake. He says he's in. McCarthy breaks into a grin because he knows that with Roy Cohn, he could become the biggest player in D.C. To hell with President Eisenhower. To hell with the Senate leadership. They thought they could silence him. They thought he'd just go away. but he doesn't have any plans to disappear. And from now on, he doesn't have to answer to anyone, because Joseph McCarthy is now the real power in Washington. From Wondery, this is episode 2 of 5 of Red Scare from American Scandal. On the next episode, Joseph McCarthy's subcommittee ushers in a new era of fear and paranoia in Washington, but one of his enemies will prove to be his strongest yet. If you'd like to learn more about Joseph McCarthy and the era of McCarthyism, we recommend the books Demagogue by Larry Tye and The Life and Times of Joe McCarthy by Thomas C. Reeves. This episode contains reenactments and dramatized details. And while in most cases we can't know exactly what was said, all our dramatizations are based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written by Michael Canyon Meyer, edited by Christina Malzberger. Our senior producer is Gabe Riven. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called 6 Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out 6 pop culture themed trophies for 6 basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto, I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some, But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make 6 Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow 6 Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.